Boyd. Up next on Think, the expression fashion police didn't come out of nowhere. Societies around the world have tried to regulate what people wear in public for centuries. We'll spend this hour with Stanford Law Professor Richard Thompson Ford, who, as the son of a tailor, was raised with a sense for just how much our clothing communicates about status, power, and values. We'll talk about 15th century statutes that forced Jewish women to wear gold hoop earrings, about laws written to shut down transgender expression, and about why the Sunday best look for civil rights demonstrations in the mid-20th century evolved into the black radical chic aesthetic of turtlenecks, natural hair, and sunglasses. Our conversation starts after a short break. Richard Thompson Ford was raised by a tailor who instilled in his son a lifelong appreciation of well-made, beautifully fitted clothing. Ford grew up to be a professor at Stanford Law School, and he's always been fascinated by the rules around appearance in different societies, those dictated by custom and peer pressure, as well as those spelled out in formal statutes. His book is called Dress Codes: How the Laws of Fashion Made History. Rich, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
So your sense is that what we wear has a lot to do with what we want to say about ourselves to the world. So as a guy who was a finalist in Esquire magazine's Best Dressed Real Man contest, and as a working dad and a law professor, what do your clothes communicate about your identity and your values?
Well, several things. You know, my father was an example, as you mentioned. He trained as a tailor, but he was also a university administrator. And his elegant style, and he was an elegant and well-dressed man, said a lot about the way he wanted to connect with his own identity and his professional status. And I think my clothing, I learned a lot from him. And so, you know, I dress in a way that conveys professionalism and dignity, I hope. I also think it's a lot of fun. And so, you know, it certainly tells you something about my interests. I'm interested in Italian fashion, for instance.
Efforts to enforce rules about fashion have never just been the domain of people who were presumably really into fashion. There was a riot in New York in the 1920s because a street gang objected to men wearing straw hats after September.
Yes, the famous straw hat riots. And, you know, apparently they stretched the entire island of Manhattan from Harlem down to the Battery. And the rule was you couldn't wear a straw hat after September 15th. Now, this wasn't a law, but it was an unspoken but well-known rule. Or it was a well-known rule. And people would knock the hats off of passersby and impale them on pikes. So it turned into, you know, quite a melee of people fighting to save their hats from the rioters and the rioters fighting to enforce this rule that you couldn't wear a straw hat after the 15th.
Wow. And of course, today, millions of Americans encounter dress codes every single day at work, at school, private businesses like restaurants or clubs. How often do challenges to those kinds of dress codes find their way into the courts?
More often than you'd think. I teach employment discrimination at Stanford, and I was surprised at the number of discrimination cases that involved a dress code of one kind or another. There have been legal challenges involving dress codes that require women to wear makeup or high-heeled shoes. There have been legal challenges to dress codes that regulate hairstyles when the dress codes include bans on hairstyles primarily worn by African Americans, like braids or dreadlocks. There have been legal challenges involving religious garb. So these challenges run the gamut. In the 1970s, there were challenges brought by men who wanted to wear their hair long when the employer required it to be cut above the collar. There are a lot of legal lawsuits involving dress codes in one way or another.
Is it legal, broadly speaking, for employers to have different rules for male and female employees and how they're attired at work?
Yes, it is. Huh. And in a sense, that's surprising, since the law formally prohibits discrimination because of sex. That's a provision of federal law under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. However, very quickly after that law was passed, the court said that doesn't mean that an employer can't have normal culturally accepted make distinctions between men and women. And so men bringing challenges for dress codes that allowed women to have long hair but forbade it for men, they lost those lawsuits. And even the lawsuits in more recent years requiring, for instance, women and only women to wear makeup, the employers usually win those lawsuits and their dress codes are upheld.
On the other hand, it is not legal, as I understand it, to write statutes that make different rules for people by race. But a lot of employers over time have sort of written the rules to exclude the kinds of hairstyles that their black employees would choose.
Yes, that's right. So you a racially discriminatory dress code would be unlawful, but a dress code that applies equally to everyone, but in fact prohibits hairstyles predominantly worn by African Americans, those have often survived legal challenges, particularly because they're often embedded in a much broader set of prohibitions. So an employer that outlaws all or bans all sorts of hairstyles, and it includes, let's say, braids or locks, those dress codes typically survive legal challenges, even though they may fall with disproportionate effect on African Americans.
All right, for clothing to become a status symbol, of course, there had to be some way of easily differentiating the quality of what different people wore. You go way back in the history and note that a big change happened in the 14th century when men moved away from draped garments, like the kinds of things, I guess, that we saw on, you know, classical Greek statues and that sort of thing, and started wearing more tailored items. Why would that have made a difference?
Well, it made a difference because this tailored clothing, and it seems that this clothing was originally designed to be worn underneath plate armor. So you get the development of tailoring techniques to design something that will conform to the limbs of the body. But over time, it became fashionable to wear this clothing, you know, even when one wasn't wearing armor, and that made it high status. People who wore plate armor were high status people. Over time, that became a fashion statement, a statement of status, and the techniques that were developed became more elaborate and allowed for much more differentiation in the types of clothing that could be made. And that led people to try to express more with respect to fashion, certainly social position and high status, but over time, lots of other things were subtly expressed through kind of sculpting the body itself through clothing.
Yeah, so how did the shift away from draped clothing to more tailored stuff for everybody, or at least for all men initially, correspond to the earliest inklings of our ideas about individualism?
Well, it's subtly. So at first, you have the use of fashion as the fashion becomes more expressive, as I've described it, in order to express social status. And these were societies where a lot of things were communicated visually and through spectacle. Large parts of the population is illiterate. And so in many ways, the way one can present oneself is a sign of power. And this is, you can see this quite clearly when you look at, for instance, Henry VIII or Queen Elizabeth I, and the way they're using very elaborate and very sumptuous clothing in order to show that they're the monarch. They're in control of the society and they are, you know, cut above other people. But what happens over time is that other people want to get in on the action too, because the people at the top, you know, they're the people who everyone pays attention to. You care about the king and the king's personal story. No one's paying attention to the merchant, but the merchants are starting to make money. The economy's changing. And so the merchant then thinks, well, you know, I'm important too. I'm going to wear this kind of clothing to express how, you know, I matter. And over time, that shift creates the use of clothing in order to shore up a sense of individual dignity and individual significance.
So it would seem as if laborers wore different clothes according to trade, and they wore different clothes than merchants. Merchants wore different clothes than royalty just by virtue of what they had to get done physically every day and their budget for clothing. Why were laws deemed necessary to encode those rules?
Yeah, so absolutely, there were some of the social distinction came from just ability to pay. So sumptuous clothing was only available to people who had money. However, two things happened. One, you started to get a market in used clothing, and so the clothing could kind of trickle down But two, and more importantly, as the economy changed, and in some sense, the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance period was a period a lot like recent years here, where new technologies and new types of trade were making a new class of wealthy people. So you have wealthy merchants and wealthy tradespeople. Well, now they have the money to afford that expensive clothing as well. And they want to get in on the action. Sometimes it's to try to pass themselves off as members of the aristocracy. But I think more often it was in order to send this message that I'm important too, that we as merchants, we as skilled tradespeople also deserve dignity, and we also deserve attention and social esteem. And that's a threat to the social order that's based on a rigid hierarchy. So you start to get laws prohibiting it. Acts of apparel in Tudor England, and there were many, many of them, strictly delineating who can wear what. And these kind of sumptuary laws actually swept Western Europe. There are examples of them all over Western Europe that are explicitly designed to make sure that people dress according to their social status.
So I had seen trunk hose before. I think I probably called them the Shakespeare bubble skirts for men.
Yes.
But how could men get in trouble for wearing those? Who were they for, and who would be punished for wearing them because they weren't worthy of the look according to the law?
Well, this was one of the things where the rationales blended. So the trunk hose that a common person could get in trouble for were considered to be against public order because too elaborate. Now, the official justifications involved things like they used too much fabric or they were just outrageous. But you'll have a proclamation, for instance, where someone or a legal order against someone who wore a monstrous and outrageous pair of hose contrary to good order. So they were seen as vulgar, too flamboyant, but also uppity, above one station. And the punishments could be anything from one person, for instance, was ordered before the magistrate who had the linings cut out of his trunk hose and then trailing behind him as he was marched through the streets as an example of folly for all to see.
Rich, this is strange. There were laws about what women couldn't wear for fear of looking somehow too much like a temptress. Jewish women in Italy were required at one point to wear gold earrings at a time when gold earrings were associated with sinfulness. So what was that about?
Yes, that's right. So at this time, and in some northern Italian cities, Jewish populations and the Christian population were fairly well integrated. But there were those in the religious establishment that didn't like this and wanted to ensure that one could identify Jewish people on site. So one, presumably one wouldn't be at risk of having interactions with Jewish people that the church was trying to discourage. And they used several techniques, but in northern Italy, where Christian women didn't typically wear earrings and they had started to become associated with sin as vanities, some of the laws actually required Jewish women to wear earrings in order to set themselves off. But also, it was clear, made the association between the Jewish faith and sinful luxury and seductiveness, and tied those two together symbolically.
On the other hand, Muslim women in the modern world who choose to dress modestly have sometimes been informed by other people, non-Muslims, that they are somehow being oppressed. Let's listen to a news clip from France. This was in 2011.
This Muslim woman defied France's new law, wearing her veil in public for a crowd of cameras. Kinza Dreider says it's her constitutional right to dress how she wishes. She says this is an attack on my freedom of being a woman. It's a big attack on my own life. Paris police detained her and two other veiled women for taking part in an unauthorized protest. The women could face $200 fines for wearing their veils in public and be forced to attend a citizenship class.
I guess, Rich, you know, you and I are from a country where religious freedom is prized. I had such a hard time getting my head around that in 2011 when it was in the headlines.
Yes, well, the French tradition of religious liberty is very different than ours in this respect. There's an idea in France called laïcité, which sometimes Americans, if they've heard of it at all, mistake for being analogous to our notions of free exercise and the establishment of religion. But it's actually a somewhat different notion, which is designed to ensure that there are parts of society that are free of religious influence. And the use of the veil or the burqa or the headscarf is seen in this context as an overt statement of religiosity that's unacceptable in certain public spaces, like public schools, for instance. And so, therefore, it has been banned in various ways.
Conversations about what transgender folks wear feel like a very modern thing. But of course, trans people have been around probably for as long as we've reserved certain looks for people who identify as either men or women. You discovered that Joan of Arc was burned at the stake, at least in part, because she was breaking the rules by dressing like a boy.
Yes. The part of the evidence of heresy, and apparently the trial was one in which people were trying to establish that Joan of Arc was a heretic. She did not fall into their traps, but they seized on the fact that she had worn men's clothing. Now, you know, she was fighting in battle, and so the men's clothing that she was wearing was the kind of undergarments that I was describing that go underneath plate armor. It's debatable how much she wanted to wear that clothing outside of the conditions of battle, how much she identified with wearing men's clothing. Men's clothing was also just more fashionable at that period of time, and some have speculated that that's part of the reason she wore the clothing. But at any rate, yes, she was then tried for violating the biblical admonishment that a man shall not wear clothing pertaining to a woman, nor a woman that of a man, and found guilty of heresy.
So men's clothing for some time among the nobility got more and more elaborate. And we've seen the lace cravats and the brocade fabrics and the delicate silk pumps and the stockings. And then came the great masculine renunciation. Explain what happened then.
Yes. So for all, as you say, for centuries, power and status and prestige was expressed through elaborate and adorned clothing for both men and women, although, of course, the styles were different. But that started to change in the late 1700s. And at first it was in England and then later spread, where a courtly dress was less esteemed. This happened in England after Charles I, who styled himself as an absolute monarch, was executed. And so the affairs of court became less important, and people began to wear more streamlined clothing. Now, it had lots of other influences, religious influences from religious asceticism, but also political ideals. And so over time, the ideal of the equality of citizens that would later mature into notions of human rights started to be expressed through this more streamlined, spare, sober clothing that expressed different virtues rather than honor and status. It was expressing industriousness and sobriety and practicality. And the egalitarian influences of all that were such that, in some sense, for the first time, people of high and low status were wearing basically the same clothing. The CEO or the file clerk, the head of state, or the lowly administrator, all wearing the same suit. Now, of course, there's still status differentiations, but symbolically, that made a big statement of a shift toward what we might now consider to be enlightenment ideals of social and legal equality.
Why did men move away from ornate clothing so long before women did?
Yes, great question. So the great masculine renunciation was exclusively masculine. And in some sense, the feminine fashions became even more sumptuous and exaggerated and expressive of whimsy in reaction to what was happening with the men. So for the first time, the entire symbolic language of men's and women's clothing really diverged, with women retaining all of the kind of sumptuousness and elaborateness that had once been common to both sexes. It took a very long time for women to adopt more streamlined clothing. They tried during dress reform movements, for instance, in the mid-1800s. Many people are familiar with Amelia Bloomer, who tried to create a kind of woman's pants that would allow women to just, you know, have practical clothing to do practical physical endeavors. It was a fashion craze for a while, but it was roundly ridiculed and kind of ridiculed out of existence and really streamlined. Women's fashions didn't really take off until the 1920s with the flappers, a group of people that people think of now as kind of frivolous, but in fact, they were working women in many cases. It was a class diverse and racially diverse group of women who adopted clothing that was more practical for them, but also allowed them to express that kind of modern sensibility that men had had for centuries earlier.
Why do you think, Rich, the flappers succeeded in changing the way women dressed forever, where the rational dress movement and the bloomer movement failed?
Well, I think the reason is that the flapper movement was embraced fashion and used the power of fashion, the expressiveness of fashion, to advance that their cause. The bloomer movement had a certain anti-fashion style to it. It started with a manifesto, in a sense. So dress reform movements that were explicitly about reforming dress ended in failure. But dress changes in dress that captured and kind of rode the wave of fashionable change and became desirable, not just because of their political statement, but because of the aesthetics and the culture surrounding it. Those were successful. So what happened with the flappers was everyone thought it was sexy. Everyone thought it was, you know, cool. And therefore, everyone wanted to adopt it for that reason, not just for the political reasons.
Of course, young women's clothing choices have been policed for a long time. This is a woman named Kyla Ebert, who was told in 2007 when she got on a flight, Southwest Airlines flight from San Diego to Tucson, that she needed to cover up.
So did you realize that you're going to get caught in such a controversy?
Never. I never imagined that this outfit would get me noticed for anything other than it's a very cute outfit.
And when they told you to leave the aircraft, could you believe what was happening?
No, and initially I wasn't told it was because of my outfit. I couldn't imagine what they would be pulling me off the aircraft for.
Was it a fellow passenger who complained about you?
No, it was a Southwest employee who felt that my outfit was obscene and was offending other people.
Sober consideration of the whole issue there by Geraldo Rivera-Rich. But on a serious note, why is women's modesty debated constantly when men's does not seem to be much of a social issue?
Yes, it's a really great question. So for centuries, you know, I mean, reaching back to the earlier example I gave in the Renaissance, women and women's bodies have been seen as a source of sexual temptation, of potential sin. And so women's sexuality has been the subject of regulation through what women wear in a way that men's clothing never has. After, you know, particularly after the great masculine renunciation, we kind of have an idea, and I think it's a mistaken idea, but it's a very powerful one, that men's fashion isn't really fashion. It's practical, sober clothing, and men's fashion isn't really sexy. It's just practical, whereas women are into fashion, women are into adornment, and women are seen as sexy. So that distinction and the idea that men are practical and women are frivolous, men are sober and women are seductive, has led women to get the bulk of scrutiny around their attire for centuries.
Art, I want to talk about the ways people have used clothing to either assert their own power or deny power to other groups. This is especially relevant when we look at the history of how African Americans have dressed over time. How did free Black people before the Civil War use clothing to signal their status?
Yes, it's really interesting. So from very early on, there were African Americans who dressed in high status European fashions using fashion in the same way that white people did, you know, as a way to communicate their status. And everyone understood that clothing did signal social rank. And they were met with a great deal of resistance. There were laws in the American South that forbid blacks and slaves from dressing above their condition. And it's worth noting that some slaves also wore this clothing, this high status clothing, depending on their positions. So at the same time, they would often use that European clothing, but add a twist that was derived from African culture. And so there's a way in which they were using it, but also transforming it for their own purposes and for their own to create their own identity. And again, this was seen as quite threatening, and people were faced with not only legal sanctions, but also private violence.
So wearing beautiful clothing became almost an act of defiance for Black people.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And you can see throughout that history, even past the Civil War and emancipation, that it was well understood by everyone involved that a Black person dressed in elegant attire was making a statement of personal dignity that in some sense was a challenge to white supremacy and to the social order of the time. And I have many, many examples in the book of people who were met with either ridicule or at worst violence as a result of their dignified and elegant dress.
Why did so many civil rights leaders in the mid-20th century advise fellow activists to always dress in their very best clothes when they were demonstrating?
Well, I think there were two reasons. One had to do with demonstrating through their elegant or dignified attire that they were people who deserved to be treated with dignity and respect. And I think the other reason had to do with what we were talking about earlier, that African Americans in elegant and dignified attire were also making a symbolic statement in opposition to white supremacy, in opposition to racial stereotypes, in opposition to the kinds of images and kind of ideas that were spread by white supremacists in order to keep Black people down. And both of those were important symbolic components of the civil rights struggle.
How did the Black Power movement come to be represented by that very distinct, very stylish aesthetic with the like ribbed turtlenecks and sunglasses and leather jackets, that sort of thing?
Yes, well, this is part of the next stage of the evolution. So a new generation of civil rights activists started to think, wanted to think about their self-presentation in a different way. To some extent, they were just related to the counterculture of the 1960s generally. So in the same way that, white political radicals didn't want to dress like their parents, this was a new generation that didn't want to dress like their parents in the mainstream civil rights movement. But they also had a very keen sense of the way that the body and the Black body was important and needed to be treated with dignity. And part of the challenge there was to reject an aesthetic that was tailored to and designed by white people. So, hair is a perfect example of this, where respectable hair in the 1950s and early 60s would have to be straightened and pressed. And the new generation of Black activists said, that's humiliating for African Americans. We need to be proud of our own natural hair, so we need a new aesthetic. And the Black Panthers, for instance, had a minister of culture who was very interested in addressing these kind of questions, and they were more aware than many other political movements of the importance of culture and aesthetics to liberation.
Okay, fast forward to 2008. Here is then-Senator Barack Obama campaigning for president.
any public official who's worrying about sagging pants probably needs to, spend some time focusing on real problems out there. Having said that, mm-hmm. brothers should pull up their pants.
Just pull up their pants.
You're walking by your mother, your grandmother, and your underwear is showing. What's wrong with that? Come on. You don't have to pass a law, but that doesn't mean folks can't have some sense.
Rich, young people of all races make choices that older folks don't necessarily love. Why is the sagging pants thing one that people just really seem to get spun up about?
Yeah, it's so interesting because it fits within this dynamic that I was describing, where there's a new generation that wants to express something different than the older generation. And the sagging pants have become associated with a particular kind of urban African American subculture that a lot of people find threatening, frankly. And that is, so there's a one generation and one set of ideals that says, don't feed into racial stereotypes by doing that. Pull up your pants. But the opposing ideal, which, you know, I would associate with the later generation of civil rights move, the civil rights struggle in SNCC and with the Black Panthers, says, you know, we shouldn't accept the mainstream white dominated aesthetic. We need to express our own connection to our communities in a distinctive way. And, you know, if white folks are uncomfortable with it, too bad. And so it's that, you know, tension between differing ideals and also differing strategies for racial liberation that are driving this. And it becomes quite, you know, quite complex.
And then there's the whole hoodie thing. I mean, I don't think there is any American over the age of two who doesn't have at least one thing in their closet that qualifies as a hoodie. Why are mm-hmm. hooded tops treated like some kind of signifier of illicit intentions only when they are worn by young Black men?
Yeah, absolutely. It's they've gotten this image in the media of the, you know, the young Black man with the hoodie on who's sort of up to no good. And it's striking that the fashion statement is very much also tied to the body. When that hoodie is worn by an African American, it has an entirely different symbolic meaning for a lot of people than when it's worn by a white person, where one might think, you know, if it's worn by a young white man, he's probably in tech. He might be running a software company or something like that. But for the Black person, they think that he's a thug or a hoodlum.
You've noted before that in university settings, sometimes tenured professors dress the worst of all. What is that about?
Yes, exactly. So, well, yes, there's a sense in which, you know, since the masculine renunciation, the idea that men don't have fashion, they're just well-dressed, has transformed itself into an idea that people not caring about fashion, not caring about how you look, is actually kind of a signal that your mind is on loftier things. So it's a signal of your seriousness not to look too fashionable, not to be concerned about the superficial. At the same time, it's also a sign of status because you're working in a profession where you don't have to care what other people think of you. These days, many of the people wearing suits and ties are people in the service industry who have to worry about what they dress like. Tenured professors don't really answer to anybody. And so dressing down at that point is, in a sense, a kind of a way of saying, you know, I'm in a position that I don't need to care about what other people think.
So you have kids, and if I did the math correctly, they're teenagers now or thereabouts. What kinds of conversations do you have with them about what they have the right to wear and how they might be perceived based on those choices?
Oh, difficult conversations, as every parent does. And my kids are very different. My son is not at all interested in fashion. He would be perfectly happy wearing sweatpants and whatever T-shirt he happens to find. My daughter, who's younger, is really into clothes. And we're trying to get her not to spend so much money on them. But yes, I try to help them see that what they wear will send a message, and, you know, with limited success, I suppose.
Well, I think we're all fighting the same battle, so I'm with you there. Richard Thompson Ford is a professor at Stanford Law School, and his book is called Dress Codes: How the Laws of Fashion Made History. Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.